You're listening to a special broadcast of an AAUW forum recorded by Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, on January 10th. This event was held at the Astoria Public Library. Speakers Eric Thorson and Andy Davis discussed Measure 101, a health care funding measure on the Oregon ballot in the special election January 23rd. Thorson is CEO of Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria, and Davis is a data analyst for Greater Oregon Behavioral Health Incorporated, which provides services to Oregon Health Plan Medicaid clients in Clatsop County. Moderator Sarah Meyer introduced the speakers and took audience questions afterwards.
Just for clarification, AAUW nationally does not endorse candidates. We are not a political being. We, as a state agency, state group and local group, we can take educational equity and help issues and come out supporting those or not supporting those. That is a state public policy abilities. And our state public policy has come out in favor of ballot measure 101. And tonight, that's our discussion, is to reinforce our interest in being healthy in the city. So we're going to start out with Eric. Andy Davis is another presenter. Andy is at a county commission meeting working on an effect of looking to get the ballot voter's pamphlet in everybody's hands for every time we have a contested race of any sort. So that's where he is. He will be over as soon as he can. So we'll just turn it on to Eric Thorson.
Perfect. Well, thanks for having me here tonight. I have a few remarks, not a long conversation from my part, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about the ballot measure or Columbia Memorial Hospital and the impacts that it might have on the hospital. What I can tell you about Measure 101, kind of similar to the opening comments, is that, you know, Columbia Memorial Hospital has really, in the time that I've been there, 15 years, never gone out and supported any ballot measure before or any candidate before. We typically try to remain, you know, apolitical and neutral on these issues. But this is an important issue for us, and I think for our community and our constituents around the state. I am fortunate enough to sit on the Oregon Hospital Association's board and represent the 32 rural hospitals that exist around the state of Oregon. And what I can tell you about 101 and leading up to 101 is that I watched through the last legislative session kind of the difficult negotiation from my, you know, seat at the Oregon Hospital Association, the negotiation with, you know, hospital leadership from all over the state, CCO leadership, the coordinated care organizations, the health insurance companies, negotiate with the legislature a package to help us plug the budget deficit that they had in the Medicaid budget for this biennium. And it was difficult. I saw the back and forth negotiations. I saw the challenges that individual hospitals were having, you know, agreeing to the assessments that are on the ballot. And, you know, through the course of the session, they did reach agreement with the legislature, and there was a package, you know, where the 0.7% assessment on large urban hospitals that doesn't affect Columbia Memorial Hospital was agreed to, and the 1.5% assessment on the health insurance plans was agreed to. And one thing that was also agreed to that was not referred and not put on the ballot 101 was an assessment on the small and rural hospitals like Columbia Memorial Hospital. So that assessment stays, you know, irregardless of what happens with 101. And we thought at the end of session that the issue was complete, and everyone kind of took a big sigh of relief and thought that, okay, we can go into the next biennium with maybe not a perfect system, but at least a solution to the budget deficits that they were facing, and no one lost coverage in that, you know, compromise, if you will, or negotiation. And then the three representatives went out and, you know, who disagreed and got the necessary signatures to refer the 0.7% assessment on urban hospitals and the 1.5% assessment on the insurance companies and the CCOs. And so they did gather enough signatures, and that is the reason why we're here really today with Measure 101. So you have, I think, over 162 healthcare type facilities and organizations supporting Measure 101 because of all the negotiation that went on and took place in session over the summer, and people thinking that it was the right answer for the next biennium. So that, to me, that's a little background from me on, you know, why we're here today. The impact, you know, to CMH if this measure goes down, I mean, it's hard to speculate exactly what happens if the measure goes down, but I think everyone, you know, around the industry that I'm in believes that it will affect coverage, and it will shrink the number of people that are covered by the Medicaid system. And I have been at the hospital for over 15 years now, and I lived through the really high uninsurance era before the ACA and the Medicaid expansion occurred. And I know how it worked before, and I know how it is working today. And I can tell you that coverage, more people that have coverage, is a much better solution than having a large population of individuals who don't have access to any coverage. Coverage provides access to care. Prior to ACA and prior to the Medicaid expansion, folks that didn't have insurance were not usually able to get an appointment at a local PCP or primary care provider. They utilized the emergency room for their non-emergent medical needs, or they ignored their medical needs and went untreated with really diagnoses that could be managed effectively through, you know, routine trips to your PCP, and instead they would build up and wait until they actually became an emergency and then come into the emergency room. So when Medicaid expansion occurred and we saw more people receive coverage, we certainly saw our emergency department visits for things that were not emergency related drop rather significantly. Now, it was good for us financially too, and I'm not afraid to say that, because I think that as a nonprofit organization, what we've been able to do with the additional income from having more people covered and not having to write off all of those, you know, invoices and bills from folks that didn't have insurance and couldn't or didn't have even the ability to pay their bill, we were able to reinvest it back into the community. And if you know anything about CMH over the past, you know, 5 to 7 years, you've seen us expand. You've seen us add services in Warrenton. We've added primary care services. We've added urgent care services. We've brought specialties to the area. We've just completed a new cancer center. We would not be able to do those types of activities without the financial stability that not all, but some of the coverage, you know, the folks that have gained coverage through expansion and the ACA has contributed to our financial success. So in my mind, yes, it's helped us financially, but it's also helped us, you know, continue to grow and add services that, you know, provide people access to care. And we've seen in the emergency room, we've seen the appropriate, you know, not all, but for the most part, we see more appropriate things in our emergency room than we were before. You know, we have now 2 urgent care centers, and we have a number of primary care additional providers in our community. So we see those providers seeing the right thing, and we see the emergency department seeing kind of the right ailments. And that overall really does lower the cost for all of us. If we put the right patient in the right place at the right time, it will be cheaper overall for the system. If the patient ends up in the emergency room, I can tell you that the emergency room is the highest entry point into the healthcare system that there is. You cannot walk out of the emergency room with a small bill. You need to go to an urgent care, you need to go to a provider, you know, a primary care provider, and have those kind of needs met in that space and not in our emergency room. So we're supporting Measure 101 because we believe that coverage is a necessity in our community. It provides access to people that need access and feel strongly that everyone in this community needs to have coverage. So that's why the board, for the first time in the 15 years, allowed me to write the op-ed piece for the paper and kind of be here tonight supporting a measure that, you know, they've never really been out on a limb and supported political issues before. So
this is Andy Davis. Andy?
So I want to apologize first. I was a little late because Sarah may have informed you, but I was just speaking at the commissioners too, and they had a long debate over voter pamphlets, so they went a little over. And I also want to say I feel a little strange because I'm coming to you. I've been a data analyst first for CLATSA Behavioral Healthcare and now for GOBI, and one of our retired providers is in the audience tonight, and I'm sure she knows a great deal more about the behavioral health landscape on the ground than I do. I'm going to do my best, but if you want to speak up at any point, Liz, feel free. So Eric and I have kind of done the rounds on this issue in town, and we always end up speaking in this order where I follow him. And a lot of what I end up saying is that the behavioral health landscape is similar in some ways, especially in terms of escalation of cost. And difficulty for the clients when they are not getting service upstream, getting assessed quickly, getting the kind of community help and support around them that they need, they can end up in the ER just like a physical health patient would. And that drives our costs up as organizations. So GOBI is a behavioral health organization, CLATSA behavioral health organization. Both of their costs get driven up by people going to the ER. And so one of the ways that we can try to limit that and help those clients out as much as possible before they escalate to that level is to get them care earlier in their life. And for people who have insurance, that's much easier for us to do. If they're enrolled in Medicaid, we can provide them service under our capitated agreement with the state and develop programs to help those people out. And that's what's been happening in Clatsop County. Clatsop County has about 12,500 enrollees in Medicaid last year, for the whole year. 4,900 of those were 18 or under. And of that group, Clatsop Behavioral Health just told me like 2 weeks ago that they had 467 children on their rolls. So the 467 out of that total population, almost 10% of the population of under 18 individuals who are covered by Medicaid in the county, are getting some sort of behavioral health treatment. That could be that they're getting group work in the school. That could be that their parents are getting work because they have counselors in the school to work with the parents. It could be that they're getting substance use disorder treatment. There's a variety of supports here in the community, and a lot of those have been developed specifically for the Medicaid population since more funding has become available through ACA. So we've been developing programs like RAP, which is a program to work with several community supports. And so CBH, for example, or GOBI, depending on the county, would have a care coordinator who works in a clinical way with the client, who's a youth, but they also coordinate with things like the Justice Department or with the school or with physical health to try and get as much support from different systems as is possible for that client to really help them out and to prevent them from either in their youth or as adults escalating to the point where they would end up in an ER. Those programs are especially at risk in behavioral health because unlike the physical health world where most services are fee-for-service, you go to the ER, you get charged, or your insurance gets charged directly. Behavioral health is capitated for Medicaid, what it means is that there's a lump of money that comes from the federal government to the state, and that's apportioned to the counties. Each county usually has one provider. In this case, we have Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare. That provider gets a lump of money from the state depending on the size of population. And they have actuarial people who determine this is the amount of money it would take for each person to get service in behavioral health on Medicaid. And they give you an amount of money that's proportionate to how big your population is. So one of the things that is especially at risk with behavioral health is if the Medicaid expansion goes away or some portion of it goes away, if they decide they need to roll back and take people off of the Medicaid rolls, it will directly affect how much capitated money comes to the county. If suddenly instead of 12,500 people, we only have 10,000 people because they can only afford that many, the amount of money that Clatsop Behavioral Health gets upfront from the state will decline directly. And what that will mean is people that are counselors or care coordinators, case managers, so Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare is going to try to keep people like prescribers on their payroll and to try and support the higher end clinicians as much as possible. But what they'll make cuts in usually seem to be people who are doing direct care coordination type work to help support people at a sort of lower level of care. And so people will end up escalating more. Does that seem fair, Liz? Okay, you're nodding, so, okay. So my organization is GOBI. We do behavioral health administration kind of in a lot of rural counties in Oregon. And we've been fully on board with 101 and the Yes campaign and trying to get the word out as much as possible. I will also say it's kind of, is this going on the radio? Yes. Okay. I think one of the things that's been great about this process has been that there have been lots of community groups, AAUW, Indivisible, the Clatsop Democrats, that have been working together in some respects to try and organize and inform people about these issues. And I think it's been great for me to be around the table with people like Eric. I don't think I ever met Eric before a week and a half ago, but now I seem to see him all the time. It's great to see the people in the community coming out and saying this is important and we want to support people. I think that's what this is all about for me, is that there's a large population who have difficulty because of disability or because of their income level to support themselves. And we have built frameworks, financial frameworks and service frameworks to support these people. And 101 puts that at risk if it doesn't pass. So I'm happy to answer questions or try to, or put everything off to Eric. Thank you.
I've heard it said that this ballot measure wasn't written as well as it might have been. Can you address that?
I'm not sure I truly can. They write ballots by committee, I think it probably depends on both the partisan place that you come at in trying to understand the measure, and you know, I think there are elements of the measure that are very much wordsmithed by the people who wanted to, I think, ideally see it pass, really, because the Democrats controlled that committee. But why they chose certain ways of saying things are beyond my knowledge.
I'm trying to imagine what the counter to this is. Is it that people don't want to pay extra? Is it taxes that they're paying extra for the 101? Is it wastefulness that people are objecting to? I'm trying to imagine what the counter argument is. I mean, we're helping people. We love that. Can you explain the mindset of the other side to this issue, the counter 101?
Well, I can't explain the mindset, but I can tell you that it's not individuals who are being asked to pay the assessments. It's on this ballot, it's large urban hospitals agreeing to tax or provide an assessment on themselves of 0.7%, and then it's insurance companies and the coordinated care organizations, again, kind of a fee assessment on themselves of 1.5%. So no individual is impacted by those two assessments.
I haven't read the whole thing, and I'm just curious, either one of you gentlemen, for the homeless that we have in town, and we have far too many, will this passage of this be of any benefit to them, or are they already being carried for under some other program?
From the physical health side, this the passage of this did not expand Medicaid any further. So this kept the current enrollment the same. So if they were on the Medicaid rolls, they would continue on the Medicaid rolls. If they were not, the chances of any expansion of Medicaid are not covered under this initiative.
Would this be?
I would just also say, in all likelihood, for the homeless population, because they're presumably at zero or close to zero income, if the Medicaid expansion is the part that gets rolled back, they would likely be unaffected, because that the expansion is primarily people between the 100% of the poverty level and 138%, which is an income gradient that most homeless people would be below.
There seems to be some discussion that among some people or groups that this is a tax. Would this increase patients' fees at the urban hospitals? How would this be assessed?
Well, I can only really speak for Columbia Memorial Hospital. I don't know how the other hospitals will run their business. CMH is a part of the small and rural hospitals, and we did agree to a new assessment that was not part of the ballot. It wasn't referred. And from CMH's standpoint, there'll be no passing on of the assessment to patients. we are absorbing the assessment in our own profitability. So that's the only way I think I can answer that question for you.
Senator Johnson said that there is an earlier agreed upon assessment that was hospitals were paying approximately a dollar that would go to the federal government, and then the federal government would then return $1.60 or so, and then that 60 cents on the dollar would be kept by the state to help other people. So it wasn't really a cost, correct?
Correct. So there's been a system in place with the large and urban hospitals for almost 10 years where, and it's very similar, so I'm going to shift to the small and rural hospitals because it's what we agreed to enter into. The small and rural hospitals had not participated in that program over the past 10 years. And what we agreed as a small and rural kind of collective agreed to was to participate in that program where we, in essence, pay a fee to the state, and the state then is able to send, if you will, those dollars to the federal government where they're matched somewhere between 3 and 4 times, and they get that money back from the federal government. They return the fee that we paid back to the hospital, and the state then is able to utilize the match from the federal government to fund the Medicaid program. And that's, I'm sure, what Senator Johnson was speaking to. And that's the program that the small and rural hospitals like Columbia Memorial Hospital agreed to enter into effective January 1 of 2018.
Apropos of what you just said, I don't have this clear in my mind, but I've been hearing distrust that the money will actually be spent on Medicaid.
That question has come up a number of times. The monies that we're talking about, and I heard Patty Wendt speak to this question at the editorial board of the Daily Astorian, and she was a little perplexed at where, you know, the genesis of that concern was, because these monies are earmarked for the Medicaid budget, so they can't be spent somewhere else. So kind of unsure where, again, the genesis of that concern comes from.
I think just to add on to that a little bit too, since budgeting is a biannual process, if there's a concern that these funds could be redirected in a different way, or, you know, I've also heard a concern about these not being the right ways to levy an assessment, you know, that we should be putting a tax on something else, you know, that's up for argument again in a couple of years. And there's, in my mind, there's no reason not to let this go for this cycle so that you don't interrupt the, I mean, the fact is that if this doesn't pass, the legislative process this year is going to be all about trying to fix this. And it's going to make for a very inefficient and difficult process for this short legislative session, when really you could just take it up again next year if you thought it was problematic.
So I used to be a front desk lady at the health department for a long time, casual labor, and got to be an Oregon health plan outreach worker. There was some education for me about the paperwork piece and the explaining. But between the conversations I had with coworkers and the people I was meeting, it just struck me over and over and over. A big part of the problem with low-income people has to do with lack of literacy. And that affects not only their ability to do their paperwork for assistance, but also to maintain jobs, to help their children in school. So I'm just really, really bothered that anybody would urge voting no on this ballot measure, because I spent a lot of time for a part of my life working and getting to know what happens when people can't read and aren't successful in school and are called adults but can't fully engage as an adult.
So with that, I thank you very much, Eric and Andy.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having us.
You've been listening to a special broadcast on Coast Community Radio, an AAUW forum held January 10th in Astoria. Speakers addressed health care funding and ballot measure 101, which voters will decide on in Oregon on January 23rd.